I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined again by Patrick LeBrun. We're going to have to start calling this the Pat and Greg show, I think. So, Patrick, welcome to the show again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, today we're going to talk about jobs for white men. One of the things that's changed in the movement since I've gotten involved is that the number of young white men has significantly increased. And so the number of young men who are thinking about job prospects, who are high school and college age or recently out of college and still in a position where they can make significant decisions that are going to affect their long-term life prospects, are out there. We have an audience, and I think it's really time that we talk to this audience because there are lots of little changes that could be made right now that 20 or 30 or 40 years down the line will make a huge difference. And that's what we're all about. Racial nationalists are always attentive to how small changes today will create global changes in decades hence. That's the key to understanding demographics. It's the key to understanding politics. And it's the key to understanding personal decisions about jobs and finance. So Patrick is a very knowledgeable guy in terms of business. And so I thought I would ask him to basically give his advice to young white men who are looking for jobs or looking for better jobs. So I want to deal with two issues here, really. I want to deal with earning power and job security, just getting the best and most secure job possible. But then I also want to transition into talking about work and political activism, because we do want as many of our people to actually become politically active and effective. So to begin with, Patrick, can you tell me what kind of jobs are the most vulnerable to competition from women and from non-whites?
Well, I think in that category, we find a lot of the readers of the Manosphere. As I researched this article, I realized two things. One is that there hasn't been an article written that is called Career Advice for Young White Men. And the other is I've realized that there are a lot of, let's say, misconceptions within the Manosphere in terms of people judging themselves and their own positions they have. That is that they think they're in a white-collar job when in fact they're in a pink-collar job. They're in a process-oriented job in an office that has been so dumbed down and denuded of any serious decision-making or any decisions on, say, allocating capital, that there's really no value added that a well-educated white man can bring to the job.
So those are the jobs where they can be most easily replaced. Can you expatiate a bit about this distinction between a process-oriented job versus a decision-oriented job? I'm not quite grasping what you're getting at there.
Sure. Well, one example I saw on a job site where I was consulting was they were basically processing stock shares, and they would take stock shares from people who mailed them in, and it's hard to imagine that you know, in the 21st century, there are still physical shares. They would be mailed in. They had to be entered into a system, a computer system, and they had to be punched with holes. And then they're put away in a file to be kept for, I forget if it's 5 years or what. And so this was a job where, yeah, it was really a mindless kind of job. And it was the kind of job where a lot of the people had time to, you know, listen to podcasts like this one. Right, so maybe there's someone listening right now who's in this kind of a job. Another one would be a job site where they were making very low-end websites that were very standardized for small businesses. And it was essentially a factory for English literature majors because they worked in shifts. They had a foreman who wasn't paid any more than the other workers there, and they had a very highly standardized format in which they would write content, you know, both in the structure of the content, the kind of words they would use, all sorts of ways they would standardize, and employees were measured based on how much output they could put that would fit a basic minimum standard for matching with, you know, for what they were promising to these small businesses to have in their website. So this is can be contrasted with a job where you're deciding on how to allocate capital, or you're making decisions on who to hire and who not to hire, or you're the face of the company in a relationship with a client or a supplier, and you're in a position to negotiate price, volume, this kind of thing. Those kinds of jobs are a lot harder to replace and a lot harder to be turned into a process. It really takes a qualitative knowledge, not just a speed at implementing rules-based creations. And I think that, you know, that basically, if you talk to people in corporate America especially, when they think of these kinds of process-oriented jobs where you can't go outside of the lines, they have a lot more confidence in non-whites in doing these jobs. They find that they're much more reliable in only doing what I think everyone's had this experience where they've had, you know, whether it's facing a government bureaucrat or, you know, a big city parking lot attendant, where a black woman says to you, oh, well, I, the manager's not here. I can't make that kind of decision. Now, I think others have had a similar experience where they've had a white man in that position, and he says, I'll see what I can do for you. The bosses don't want that worker to say, I'll see what I can do for you. They want that worker to screw you and to treat you as much as a commodity as they can. And that's how they maximize returns. And so they've come to this conclusion that white men are not as, don't fit as well in these positions. Unfortunately, a lot of white men still go to these positions thinking that they're going to find job security or that it somehow fits with their capabilities and strengths. I would challenge them and say that their capabilities and strengths lie elsewhere.
Right. So the distinction is between following decisions or rules made by other people as opposed to being in a position where you can make some decisions. Is that one of the issues? Because it seems to me, obviously, that the people who can actually make decisions are scarcer than drones who simply move pollen from one area to the other of some grand hive that somebody else has created.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and if you can be trusted to make these kinds of decisions, then you'll be, and you're trusted to actually add value to the corporation when doing this, then you'll be given a higher compensation. Now, you may not have as much security, but frankly, I don't think that security is really something that exists these days for any kind of job.
Right, right. So why don't you tell us a bit about some of the common mistakes that our listeners are probably making right now in their jobs today?
Well, one thing would be that when they get a job, they stop looking for a job. And this is a problem. It's very easy to, it's a bit like someone running onto a subway car and stopping as soon as the door, they get across the threshold. You know, it's, you have to keep going. You have to keep looking for something better and something that fits you better. And the labor market is very dynamic. And so what you're worth today may not be what you're worth 6 months from now. And so you may be locking yourself in at a lower value than you're actually worth. So I would say keep looking, keep your resume fresh, and keep striving to find a better position while you're in a comfortable position. Don't wait till you're about to get fired to look for another job. And that also goes not just for looking for a job, but networking as well. You know, if you're in a small town, you know, go to the Lions Club or something like this, or the Optimist Club. You know, meet people and interact with them. And this is, it's something that's intimidating to meet strangers and try to get along with them. But if you have a few tools in your toolkit to do it, and you have a bit of, let's say, expectations about what they're looking for, and get rid of any misconceptions about their attitude to interacting with you, then it becomes a lot easier because students will often, well, they're never in a better opportunity to reach out to professionals to interact with them. But very few do. You know, they think, oh, this person's so important or busy. They should, you know, I'm a nobody. They wouldn't be taking their time to interact with me. Right.
One piece of advice that I always give to people is just to ask. I remember one time I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was at the Fogg Museum at Harvard. And I went into their works on paper section. They have this room. The things aren't on display, but they have them in storage. And I went in there. I just wandered in. I didn't even really know what the room was for. Wandered in. There was a desk there. I walked up to it, and I asked this young woman, "Do you have any William Blake watercolors?" And she said, "Just a sec." And she pops up and disappears, and she comes back out a few minutes later with this library cart with two levels stacked with matted William Blake watercolors, original watercolors by William Blake. They were matted, and they had like a tissue over them. And she put an easel on the table, and she just let me look through these watercolors by Blake. And I thought, well, this is pretty amazing, you know. And so I said, "Do you have anything by Burne Jones?" Finally, she took me into the storage area at the museum and pulled out these huge wall panels by Burne Jones and Rossetti. Most of the stuff in museums is in storage. They don't have the wall space to display it. And I learned that just by asking. I was there. I was interested in art, and I asked. And I got a private tour of stuff that people just can't see. So anyway, that taught me a big lesson. Just ask, because sometimes you'll get it. Another thing that really people need to bear in mind, and I think this is a great life secret, okay, something that I learned a long time ago, and I wish I'd learned it sooner. It's logically not possible. It's psychologically, I should say, not possible for people to like you as much as you think they should. And most people just suffer torments until they learn that it's simply not possible for them to gain all the recognition from others that they think they should gain. And once you realize that that's simply impossible and stop wanting it, it's a freeing kind of thing, right? You suffer a lot less, pout a lot less, you feel overlooked a lot less. But most people don't know that, and most people are very needy for recognition. And so, you know, you think that some professor or some potential mentor is a really, really big and unattainable person. They'd never want to condescend to talk to you. But the chances are they have huge unmet ego needs, and everybody's favorite topic of conversation is himself. So just ask. Oftentimes you'll find that great professionals, exalted people in your field, are going to give you not just the time of day, but they're going to give you a lot of advice. They're going to give you a lot of access that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't asked for it. So that's just a huge truth that we have to bear in mind. Everybody likes to talk about himself. Most people have extreme unmet ego gratification needs that can be gratified when you ask them to share their knowledge or their advice or their expertise or open up their networks to you. So that's something to bear in mind, definitely.
And that's absolutely right. And especially as a student, there's never a better opportunity to reach out and make these kinds of relationships than when you're a student. Most people have an open door policy. Now, you may have to ask them more than once because they'll be busy. They'll say, "Oh, yeah, I'll get back to you," and then they get, you know, sidetracked in something else. But be persistent and polite, and you'll find that oftentimes they'll get back, "Oh, yeah, sorry, you know, let's set up this time."
Well, that's the story of my life. I'm very busy. I get lots of mail. I lose track of it. If I don't immediately respond to something, I'll lose track of it because there are 300 more emails to deal with by the time I think about what to say. And I try to, you know, come up with something fresh, not just have some little standard, "Thank you very much for your kind words" kind of thing, and hit send.
Right.
And yeah, so I lose track of people. But, you know, I do like to respond to people. And if they remind me of things, I will get back to them. So yeah, a lot of people who seem very forbidding and remote are actually less forbidding and remote than you think they are. And if you learn that lesson, the way up is significantly cleared for you. So that is something very useful to know. So a lot of people just, you know, they take a job because they're operating from an attitude of scarcity because they need a job. They need it, right? So they take the first job that's offered. And they don't like searching for jobs because they associate that with need. But the trouble is that you make the worst decisions under exigency, right? When you really need something, when you need a place to live, you'll grab something, and it's often a bad decision. When you make decisions based on a situation where you don't really need to make a change, you can make better decisions. You can look longer. You can find things that fit you better. And so in a way, once you have a job, that's really the best time to start looking for a job, right?
Absolutely.
A job that really fits you.
That's right. It's very hard also, I think, when you're, you know, 20 or 21, and especially if you come from a family that doesn't have a professional background and you're in college and you're looking at professional careers, to really get a sense of where you would fit, where you would go. You know, I don't have the answer for everyone, but I'll tell you one easy question that I would ask college students who are thinking about going into finance. And that is, I would say to them, do you prefer to play turn-based strategy video games, or do you prefer to play first-person shooter video games? And I'd say, you know, if your answer is for the first, chances are you're a much better fit for investment banking. If you like first-person shooter games, chances are you're a much better fit for the trading floor. Because how do you like to make decisions? How are you comfortable making decisions? How are you excited? What motivates you to stay focused on a problem? It's very different between those two areas in the same sector. And so thinking a bit outside the box on where your comfort zone is, where your passions are, may help you answer the question about what career path to choose in a field that is really still a mystery to you.
Right. So how much is intelligence or level of education correlated with this success? And are there other factors that determine success, perhaps even more so?
Right. Yeah. You know, sadly, you know, in a lot of fields, pedigree does matter. So I wouldn't say intelligence or, you know, it is a kind of education that still matters. But really the most important things for just generally speaking, who are the people who are successful by their own definitions? Who are the people who are satisfied with their lives? And they're the ones who have figured out what are their passions, what are their strengths, and they've pursued those. And they've turned it into a career. I think there's a phrase, what is it, if you love your work, if you love your career, that you never work a day in your life, something like this. Because for them, it stops feeling like work when they're pursuing their passions.
Right. A lot of people are talked out of even trying that because they have parents or practical people who say, no, you know, that's a pipe dream. Get a law degree or something like that. Get something that you can bank on. And my advice generally to people is, if they're young, of course, it's better to do it when you're young, is to try doing what you love, and then if you fail at it, you've got the rest of your life to be practical. Now, if somebody's 50, I wouldn't be saying the same thing to them generally, because you've got less life ahead in which to be practical. But I do think that people who are successful in some area, one of the main things that has to be there is it's got to be a good fit for them. It's got to be a good match for them.
Yeah.
It's got to go with rather than against the grain of their character and their innate talents. And if you are an introspective kind of guy, making a lot of money in sales is just a bad fit. You know, you might be sold by people like Tony Robbins or something like that on the idea that you can remake yourself into a winner.
Right.
But generally the people who actually are winners, they are going with the grain of their character, their nature, their talents, rather than against it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's certainly okay to, say, expand your competencies in your 20s, but by the time you hit 30, you should really be focusing on your core competencies and yeah, trying to put the sails where the wind is blowing, I guess, and really getting a sense of who you are and focusing on those strengths.
Right. I wrote a piece on potential that's on the Countercurrents website, which just made the basic point that it's a great compliment for a young man to be full of potential, but by the time he's 30 or 40, it starts sounding like a really hollow compliment to say, oh, he's got boundless potential. By then, you should really be something. The best thing to be, of course, is to have a job and a life and an identity that's really authentic, that's really you, as opposed to wearing a mask or carrying burdens that you can't really carry, because that is really a prescription for misery. Really, there's no choice about being who you are. I remember, I think it was Mark Twain who said, be yourself is not the kind of advice you want to give to most people, which yeah, it's funny, but the truth of the matter is that you don't really have an alternative to being yourself, right? There's only, the only alternative you've got is to be yourself well or be yourself badly. To be yourself well means to have a life that accords well with your nature. And to be yourself badly means to have constructed a life that doesn't fit well.
Right. Well, the first is passion, because if you're going to be good at anything, you need to spend thousands of hours doing it. You need to put in more than 40 hours a week to get to the top of your field. And if you are just in it for the paycheck, that's going to get old eventually. Even if you can keep it up for years, you know, somehow in the end it will come out that this is just not the right fit for you. And the other thing is emotional intelligence. You know, if you have a very high IQ, you can really excel in technical jobs or in, let's say, process-oriented jobs. But if you want to make the leap to managing people, then it suddenly becomes a much more difficult job for those who have low emotional intelligence, because you're suddenly dealing with irrational factors. So if you have this ability, and it can be cultivated, to read people, to understand where they're coming from, to negotiate between different groups, this is a very valuable skill to have, and really necessary to make it into a management level position. And then in general, and this is for, you know, before you make it to that management level position, before you're even given the chance, is that you're always being watched to see if you're reliable and consistent. And that matters so much more than intelligence. That matters so much more than so many other things to a manager. And I guess the last thing I'd say as well, and this is a across the board from, you know, a restaurant owner to a CEO of a bank, is that every boss hates surprises. So figure out when you're in a position, if you have any way of dealing with surprises, dealing with problems before they get out of hand, and you can solve them in a way that you can anticipate the kind of decision they would make, and make that decision and bring them a finished issue. This is so much more valuable than bringing a surprise that's something that's not fixed. And it's so amazing how many people won't take the initiative to fix something obvious. You know, I'll just use a restaurant example. Maybe everyone can relate to it. You know, if somebody doesn't show up for their shift, it doesn't take a genius to say, well, maybe let's call somebody else up who's at home and see if they can come in. You don't have to wait for the manager to come in who's busy doing something else and then say, you know, oh, this guy didn't come in. And this is true for every level of job, every level of job. Don't let them be surprised. Always have some kind of solution when you bring them a problem. And always be willing to expand your comfort zone and go beyond your description to achieve that. Unless, of course, you're in a union job, then you might piss off your colleagues.
Right. Well, really, I mean, everybody who's going to move up in any kind of job needs to be doing things over and above what's in their job description.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as you're in that job, when you do that, in effect, you're giving the company a great big gift.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is the way that you rise in their estimation and actually rise in rank and responsibility and pay. One factor that my mother mentioned when she was hiring people, for her, it was the only factor that she saw worth mentioning, is that she would never hire sour, unhappy acting people. She just didn't. Yeah. She didn't want to be around sour, unhappy acting people. And one of those in an office or a team It was the one bad apple problem. And so there were never any people like that hired under her on her watch. She didn't want to have those kinds of people around. And I should add that she's not exactly the sunniest person on the planet. But she wasn't going to give any points for people who were sour and introverted, even though they might be deep and brilliant. Another thing that occurs to me is when I was teaching, the most helpful thing for me in learning how to improve my teaching skills was a book called Body Language for Effective Teaching. It just taught me how to read people who are not speaking, people who are sitting there silent and listening. I study that, I internalize that, and I use that probably unconsciously now every single day of my life. Just learning how to read basic body language is enormously important. So let's talk about self-help books and things like that. I think that's probably the one self-help book I've actually read. It was the Body Language for Effective Teaching. But I know there are important books out there that might help people improve their games. And there are, unfortunately, some people who can't escape office jobs and office politics. So what do you recommend as resources for everybody, but especially people who are in the office world?
Yeah, for me, the life-changing book would have been, and I always forget the number, I think it's The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene. And that is just so, so valuable to understand politics on a personal level, whether it's in work I've done in the professional world or in the political world. Because even if you're working in mainstream politics in the political world, you'll find that it's not ideology that's really driving the decisions between different camps. It's really all about personality. It's all about personal relationships. And this is just the 48 laws are spread in a way that's very easy to remember. He'll give a description of what it is and then a few historical examples and then a kind of image to help you remember it, which is all very valuable to bring it on board because there are so many of them. But it is just so, so valuable. And yeah, I won't mention the leap I had from one position to another thanks to that book, but it was pretty wild. It's pretty amazing. Now, it helped that, you know, what I was doing, I was a kind of secret agent, you know, because I was already a white nationalist in a group that didn't agree with our ultimate goals and overriding values, but had some things that we would, some common goals in mind, those common objectives. And that helped because I could have some emotional distance between, you know, myself and what was going on around me. So it made it easier to apply these laws. But yeah, that is the most important. And then I'd say the other is really the classic that every salesman has probably read, and that's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And that's just some really, I think it's 7, maybe 8 basic things that just make it really easy to break the ice and get along with people when you're just starting out a relationship.
That's really useful. That's really interesting. I have read the 48 Laws of Power just because I'm interested in political philosophy. Two other books that I really would recommend. Well, one book and one TV show, actually, for those who are not book-oriented. The first is a book called The Art of Worldly Wisdom by Balthasar Gracian. I think he was a 16th or 17th century Spanish writer. And it's a great book. It is sort of a book of self-help, I guess. It's a book about how to deal with people. And it's very practical and very powerful. And the other thing that I would recommend is a couple of BBC comedy series. The first is called Yes Minister, and the second is called Yes Prime Minister. And basically, it follows this minister from being a minister to being a prime minister. And there's a group of bureaucrats who surround him, led by this figure named Sir Humphrey Appleby, who's the Minister for Administrative Affairs. And basically, it's just a comedy about office politics in Great Britain. And there are so many useful little lessons you can learn from that show. And you'll be laughing the whole time. And because It's really funny. It's really witty. It's quite memorable. And it's a great way of learning some very practical lessons in a very easy way.
You know, you mentioned earlier giving more to the organization. And I've never read I don't even remember the name of it now. One of these New Age books. It's not The Gift. It's the Secret, I think it is. The Secret. But I think part of it is this idea of abundance in life and not having an idea of scarcity in your mind. And this is probably closely related to what your mother was looking out for, you know, keeping, you know, the Debbie Downers out of her office and off of her team. Also, if you act in life with a sense of abundance and you're not always keeping an account of your interactions with others, you know, people will take advantage of it at times, you know, people will try to screw you. But also be ungracious. But I think that if you apply it long enough with the right people, our people in particular, you'll find that doors will be opened for you as a result, that you'll build up a store of gratitude in others that will help you out later on. It all relates to networking. I would relate it more to that than to any I'd say other plane kind of interactions. But that's a valuable mindset to have. I wouldn't agree with everything that Kievsky writes on business. Particularly, I would be very cautious about getting involved with multi-level marketing. But I know he talks a lot about these things, about, you know, weaponizing the mind and about these, having a concept of abundance and how this kind of sets our people apart and how it's a valuable skill to have.
Another thing that we should talk about that's very important is if you're in a job now, you should be searching right now for the next job, a better job. Don't wait until you lose a job to start searching for a new job. And the reason for that is related to this whole psychology thing. The worst decisions you'll ever make in life are decisions based on fear and decisions under financial pressure. And so a lot of people who are searching for a job, well, they're under financial pressure. They've got to get a job. The necessity is pushing them along. And they're afraid that they won't find something. And oftentimes people will take things that aren't really the best job for them, but it's offered to them. They'll grab it, and then what they do is they want to relax. They want to get out of that job search mentality. When really, once you've gotten a job, that's the time for you to start thinking about your next job because there's less pressure on you at that point. You can be a little more strategic in your pursuit. If something is offered to you, you can afford to bargain with them. You can learn how to drive a hard bargain. These are the best opportunities when you're not needy, absolutely, when you're not pushing it, when you're not tense, when you're not behind the eight ball, then really good things start happening. And I sort of found that in my life, the best outcomes that I've had have been in times when I stopped being too concerned about the outcome. And one of the best ways to not be too concerned about the outcome is not to be in a situation where you're really in an emergency situation where you've got to have a certain outcome. If you're secure, meaning if you've got money, if you've got a job already, then I think that you can sort of sit back and allow events to happen. You can take them or leave them. You can be willing to risk losing the job because you want to drive a harder bargain. You learn so many things when you're in that kind of secure position that you don't learn and don't dare try if you're just desperate to find something and motivated primarily by fear.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, and from my own experience, I can say that, you know, I had a period in my career where I really jumped from job to job. And so one of the main things that HR people see at a certain point is they'll think, okay, well, maybe this person is not really going to stick around, so we don't want to invest in training. What you have to do is convince them that you had a goal in mind all along as you've been jumping from job to job. And that goal is the position that they're offering and the kind of institution you wanted to work for. is one like theirs that offers some kind of upward mobility or lifestyle balance or whatever it is they have to offer, understand that company and its culture and mirror that back to the HR person and convince them of that. And, you know, I'd say that, you know, integrity in one sense is very important in business. It's really hard to kind of really define where it begins and ends. But I can tell you that, you know, when you read these job descriptions, very often what you end up doing is not nearly as prestigious and challenging and educational as what's described. So padding your resume, whatever I could say, you know, exaggerating your role on different teams, you shouldn't feel bad about this because, frankly, everyone else out there is deploying that. And so if you, you know, don't be the, you know, the spearman of Pompeii on this one, you know, you got to get down in the dirt and compete with these people who are part of the strategy of displacing our race and of replacing us in the land of our ancestors and in this land as well in the United States. Do what you have to do to get ahead.
Right. I do think it's important to realize that, yeah, a lot of the jobs that you're applying for are overselling themselves too. It's unfortunate that the coin of the realm in business today is exaggeration and cant and bullshit. Mm-hmm. But if you are too pure to pay them in that coin, you're going to lose out to bad people who have no moral qualms about it at all. And then what does that do to the overall moral level of civilization when you get right down to it? It's not good. So let's transition into talking about work and politics. What are the worst possible things for white nationalists to do in any job setting that they're in right now?
I'd say talk about white nationalism. That's probably the number one, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the reaction is, well, wait a second here. It's cowardly not to talk about things that you really believe are true and important.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
I would have a hard time pointing to an example in history of a group that was hated and marginalized that took the path to victory via openness, sharing their hearts with others, and in particular, putting their ability to support their own families at risk in the process of doing that. That's something I've never seen. Now, what I have seen from history is subterfuge, triangulation, and all other manner of trickery and of strategic thinking. Strategic thinking means that the shortest distance between A and B is not a straight line. It means that you have to get around the obstacles in your way. You have to surprise the end point when you arrive there. And so that means, you know, the revolution will not be won by keyboard warriors, and it will not be won by people who shoot their mouths off at the risk of their jobs.
Right. The answer that I have to that basically is this, that if every white nationalist were to declare himself a thought criminal, mm-hmm. a heretic, an immoral person from the point of view of the mainstream today, everyone were to declare himself to his or her boss and lose a job, what would be stronger at the end of that process, the system or our movement? Obviously, the system would be stronger.
Yeah.
And we don't want that to happen. And therefore, we have to accept that it's not only necessary, but also admirable, really, for a significant number of our people to approach their jobs as if they were secret agents mm-hmm. behind enemy lines. I think that there's nothing dishonorable about that. That's how one wins a war. And it's not like our enemies are honorable, and it's not like they got into positions of power by telling the truth, quite the opposite. And we need to be as clever as they are, and cleverer, and mm-hmm. even more so. A lot of people imagine themselves at the head of some grand army marching off into battle. Well, we're not at the head of a grand army marching off into battle. We are more analogous to guerrillas, and we have to fight like guerrillas. And that means that we have to throw aside certain romantic notions of suicidal charges and things mm-hmm. like that. Now, I am 100% opposed to the basic bourgeois ethics, which says that there's nothing worse than a violent death, that there's nothing worse than giving up money and security during your lifetime. That basically makes you a slave, because if that is your attitude, the system will always find a way of setting their level of intimidation at the exact point to keep you silent and working with them rather than against them. So we have to stop being bourgeois men. We have to be the kinds of people who have ultimately put death before dishonor, because those are the kinds of people who cannot be controlled. This is why suicide bombers scare the hell out of Jews and the bourgeoisie, basically, because the very idea of somebody who's willing to die for honor or for a political agenda, it's terrifying to them. I remember after 9/11, there was some objectivist libertarian discussion board that I was on, and there was an article that was posted. It was kind of a cry of terror. We want to live. And I just thought, well, that is your greatest disadvantage, right? Mm-hmm. The people who ultimately put survival above honor are going to be enslaved by the people who put really death before dishonor. However, that all being said, that's a long preface. You only got one death, right? So you better use it wisely. And you can only get fired so many times in your life before you become effectively a burden on the movement rather than an asset to it. And we have to keep that in mind. There are people that I know who have become burdens on the movement because they've done stupid things, lost their jobs, or gotten in trouble with the law, and they expect their comrades to help them out. And at a certain point, you know, I don't want to be the one who says that, look, you did a retarded thing, you need to suffer. I would like to have a movement where people who do retarded things basically will stand up and say, look, I did a retarded thing, and I don't want you to donate your hard-earned money to helping me out. I'd rather you put the money towards something valuable, right, towards the cause, rather than helping me out because I did something stupid. That would be a really heroic act in my book. We have to have a heroic ideal, but we have to be economical about it, because frankly, there are only so many defeats and that you can suffer, and there's only one death that you can suffer, right? You may regret that you have but one life to give for the cause, but you do. And therefore, we really do have to be clever and strategic about these things, at the same time knowing that ultimately they cannot control us by bribery and terror. That, I think, is the attitude that we have to have. We have to be soldiers. We have to have a warrior ethic, but we have to be intelligent, and we have to make sure that the things that we do advance the cause rather than retard it, and we have to be an asset to the cause rather than a burden on it. And I think that if people just bear that in mind, it will help them become much more disciplined in their workplaces and in other situations rather than shooting their mouths off to show how brave they are, which is just foolhardiness.
Yeah, and the enemy we have, you know, if we slap them with a glove and tell them pistols at dawn on the hilltop tomorrow, you know, this is not their style to respond to it. In fact, their religious texts instruct them to seek us out before that time and kill us in the night, in the dark, stab us in the back. And stabbing us in the back is their preferred method over and over again, whether it's literally by Mossad agents or whether it's figuratively. In the workplace and some kind of office gossip or one of these things. But especially those who have families, you know, they have to think about buffering themselves so that they may become activists. They can't just leave activism to those who don't have families. It needs to be an all-encompassing movement. And so we've put some thought into how to figure out what jobs would be the best place to get into, a kind of safe harbor job, so that you can become an activist. And this comes from really looking over old copies of the SPLC's intelligence report and tracking, okay, who have they gone after and who have they successfully neutralized versus those they've gone after and they've failed, and they have had failures.
Why don't you run through some of those kinds of jobs that will allow people to be activists? Because we can't just have secret agents, right? And I gave my speech about people should be that if that's the best thing for them. But we can't just win it all by secret agents. We do have to have people who are standard bearers and activists and public figures There's no question about that. For those who are, what kinds of things can they do to position themselves so they cannot be economically destroyed while at the same time actually actively advancing our cause?
Right. And I'd say these apply to secret agents as well, because one day, you know, every secret agent or most secret agents get unveiled. And so
That's
they
right.
need to have a contingency plan in place, whether they're already in one of these jobs or they have one waiting for them at a place where they won't hurt the comrade helping them out, where they won't hurt the movement, and where they won't hurt the business they're going to, because the business will change their mind. And these four kinds of jobs would be where you have a one-time client interaction with the, you know, this is a business-to-client service, not a business-to-business service. You don't have a storefront. You don't have an inventory of assets. It's something that you are capable of, that you're offering that service to someone else. And when it comes to these kinds of jobs, there are a few that come to mind, but I think that anyone listening to this could really put their head to it, and sectors they know better, they could find these kinds of jobs. But when someone needs a plumber or an electrician, when someone's computer has a virus on it, or when someone's bankrupt and they need a bankruptcy attorney.
Or a divorce attorney, something like that.
Yeah.
Generally, people don't get too many of those, right? So.
Right. Yeah, and when they're in a bind, they, you know, they're in a bind. It's time sensitive, and so they just pull up the phone book, or they ask somebody, you know, do you know somebody, and they give you a call, and they're not going to do extensive research to find out what your background or political views are, and if they do, you probably, you know, by the time they've figured that out, it's too late. Either you've already delivered the service, or you already have them bound in a contract. So that would be one area, business to client, one-time interactions. The other would be union jobs, particularly, you know, some unions have better contracts they've negotiated than others, but if it involves a complicated process for firing an employee, and if you can only be fired for some kind of fault at the workplace, some kind of failure to live up to your job description, this is very safe. And this is why the movement's so much stronger in Europe, because you can't fire people for their political views in most countries. You can put people in job for in jail for some of them, but you can't fire them. And so a union job can offer that kind of protection in the United States.
That's good. So what are some other kinds? You said there were four?
Yeah, business-to-business interactions with politically incorrect clients. Now, there are it's a bit more difficult to come up with this kind of to fill this category in, because so many institutions, so many corporations are very sensitive to these issues that we deal with, and will run screaming away from anyone they have interactions with, no matter how much value you bring, if it might hurt their relationship with the Jews.
One thing I think that we should talk about is a basic truth that every white man should understand, every white racialist should understand, is that groups that work together will beat individuals who are out for their own. And that's one of the reasons why the white man in America is in such a bad situation, because we still are pursuing individualist strategies against groups that work together, and they're going to beat us. They're always going to beat us. That doesn't contradict what I just said, that as individuals we can do well. In fact, what I'm really saying is that as individuals we can really do well by becoming parts of groups that work together. And the first step towards doing that is just to network. And be the kind of person that you would like others to be for you, namely reliable, loyal, and so forth. But beyond that, we really need to think about not just networking, but tribalizing, and how to do that, how to create mutual aid societies and networks, how to create groups of people that you really trust and that you will help and they will help you, and by mutually reinforcing one another, you become a group that really is going to rise and have a future, right? And that's what we want. We want whites as a whole to have a future. But deep down in our hearts, I think that we realize that there are really two kinds of whites. There are whites without a future and whites with a future. Collectively, as a race right now, we don't have a future. But if we become the kind of people who have a future, then that problem goes away. So do you have any thoughts about tribalizing? How do you begin that process? It's not something you can just cook up. Although somebody like Joseph Smith created a tribe, basically. He just cooked it up. So what are your thoughts?
That's right. He did, yeah. I really want to underline the words you used earlier of consistency and reliability. IQs are great, but being consistent and reliable, whether you're talking about business, military, government, wherever, if you want an organization to thrive, you need to fill it with people who are consistent and reliable. Even if they're dumber than their competitors who are less consistent and reliable, such an organization will win every time.
Right. It's a tortoise and the hare kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, yeah, and in terms of tribalizing, I think that there needs to be, what makes a successful school is the ability to kick out the students who are just not able to cut it, right? And cut out the 10% at the bottom is what made GE great, and pushing the 20% at the top and giving honest feedback to people as well, not waiting till they're, like you said, the 50-year-old guy whose job's been outsourced and who isn't fit for anything that's left. And so, those would have to be principles that would guide any kind of tribalizing group, is that there has to be reliability, consistency of the members, honest assessments, and enough maturity to take on board those kinds of honest assessments to make the necessary improvements, or to accept being in a position where they follow orders, where they're disciplined, and where they're where they're at their peak potential. But there have been so many times in history where groups have done this, whether it's the Masons or the Triads or the Mafia or any number of groups of all races, of all religions have done this in the past. And this is, I think this is our only way forward. Anyone who's listened to my interventions here on a regular basis know that I don't see a future for, at least in our immediate future, overt action, that I really see clandestine organizing and clandestine action as the way forward.
I think one of the great problems with racialism, and it's a kind of paradox that we have in our movement, is that officially on paper we're hyper-elitist, but in practice we take home any little stray dog that shows up and says that he's one of us.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really have an elitist, tribalist kind of organization if you don't exercise a certain amount of discrimination. There has to be a way of demoting people as well as promoting them. We have to find ways of getting rid of people as well as attracting them. I think that we will build a functioning society in the future if we start building a functioning society, a functioning movement right now. And that really does require a certain amount of being discriminatory, a certain amount of elitism. And yeah, we should run this like General Electric.
Right, right. Yeah. Bottom 10% out.
Yeah, the sooner exactly. We start running it like General Electric, the sooner we're going to be General Electric, or even better.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One of the, it makes me think of another organization I don't want to name, but they are racialist, and there's another organization that's very similar that's not racialist. And so what they've done over the years, they joke that more than half of the membership of this other organization is composed of their rejects, because they'll just, and it's not just on the basis of racialism either that they kick the people out. They just say, it's not the right fit. We suggest you go to these other people. And they've managed to keep a leaner but much more successful organization as a result. And whereas the other one is, bulkier, less interesting, less productive, but has a larger membership. The first organization is a much more quality-focused organization. And the thing is that it would be much harder for them if they didn't have the attitude of saying, yeah, let's send them over to this other place. If they were just rejecting them with nothing but a goodbye, it makes it a lot easier process to have something else to send them to. And so, maybe that's a good thing that there are these vantards around because, you know, they can be, that's where we can send the rejects from who come our way.
Right. There's got to be a place for everyone. And I am glad that there are certain people out there doing certain kinds of things. I think that even if it's not the sort of thing I would like to do, and even if it might be 90% dysfunctional, 10% of the time it might actually serve some kind of purpose. And since there is a constituency, obviously, that's interested in this kind of message, you know, maybe we'll end up skimming off the top 10% of the people who come to us that way. And that's really my only way of sort of reconciling myself to the existence of stuff that otherwise would drive me crazy. It's like, okay, they're selling a particular kind of lemonade, and within the larger ecology of a well-organized movement, if we have the right attitudes to one another, they can still perform some kind of positive function, and that's my hope. Patrick, one of the things that I'd like to talk about are attitudes that hold our people back, and I really do think that one attitude that really is dysfunctional amongst our people is a kind of gloom and doom attitude. And on the one hand, that's totally justified because collectively, in the long run, we belong to a group that's failing. We belong to a group that's going to go extinct if we don't change the trends, okay? But just because we believe that, you know, whites as a whole are in a very perilous situation, that does not mean that we shouldn't be thinking as individuals that it is possible for us to do well in the interim in our own lives. Because no matter how bad an economy is, for instance, there's always a sector that's doing well, right? Mm-hmm. If there's a terrible downturn in the economy, that's an uptick for the people who do repossessions, right? It's an uptick for people who work in pawn shops, whatever. There's always a sector of the economy that's doing well. There are always going to be white people who are doing well in the short term before we all go extinct. And the key for me, I think, is just to communicate that kind of dual attitude that, yes, we are in a bad situation collectively, but individually, it's a duty for us to do as well as possible in the meantime, because if we do well individually, that is going to increase the possibility that collectively we're going to pull ourselves out of this death spiral. So, I mean, is there any advice you have on how whites can be attentive to positioning themselves to do well in the short to medium term within the span of their lifetimes in order to help our race as a whole do better too?
Well, when you said they have a moral duty, you're absolutely right about that, because if, you know, the young men who are listening to this podcast still are the resistance, they are the renaissance waiting to happen for people. They're the ones our people depend upon to turn this ship around. And so it's up to them to take over those positions that you described that are going to do well in difficult times, to anticipate what's coming, to be creative and to be aware. And as well to be, in a sense, in a spiritual way, detached and able to ride above it, rise above the problems around them. And to be able to overcome that and to not become this kind of Debbie Downer that's never going to get hired. It's not, and if they're the Debbie Downer that's never going to get hired, they're not going to be part of that resistance, because they'll be scraping by for peanuts for the rest of their lives, rather than having a position of strength from which they can be activists and be part of the solution to our problems. Because the problems we face, it's true, they're, you know, of historic proportions. And it's not going to be solved by the elite that we have in place. The elite we have in place is totally corrupt. They're, you know, the 40% of the oligarchy, or however you want to measure it, that's Gentile, does not give a shit about the rest of the race. You know, they do not care as long as their wealth keeps accumulating, even though they have, you know, not a single one of them has more than 50 years to live. It's up to us to take those positions of strength and to fight back. And so if you're listening to this now, you know, this, the advice you've heard on this is good advice. not just because it's us saying it, but because this is, you know, we're not the only ones out there saying this. If you go to others who just talk about business and who avoid this subject like the plague, you'll hear similar advice. And so, you know, don't get sidetracked in learning this new thing, especially if you're new to this area and you're new to understanding the problems, and burn yourself out and read and read and read until finally you just can't take it anymore. You have to set aside time in your life every week, and maybe even regulate it. I have this many hours to read, I have this many hours to comment and write on my own, and I have this many hours to be an activist, I have this many hours to advance my own personal cause, the cause of being comfortable, and the cause of starting a family, if that's the path you're going down. And so this is, I'd say that's really the main thing, is just, you know, being depressed, getting burnt out, going into overdrive, and you know, as soon as one finds out about these things, and then not being able to keep a balance in life. And if you want to learn more about keeping a balance in life, I'd say listen to Greg's podcast about classical philosophy, because there's a lot of time-tested advice in there that's very valuable. It's not the pop business advice that I'm talking about, but it's very, very valuable stuff.
Well, thanks so much. I think this is a good way of wrapping up. Become a white guy with a future.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.